Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Yep.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today's show actually started with a conversation that we had working on another show.
Which was on words.
Paper. Eagle. Clock. Green. Barrel. Cat. Alligator. Hat. Cardinal. Door. Door. Door.
So yeah, we did an hour on the power of words, and we ended up talking with this guy.
Hello.
Hello, is this Dr. Fernyhough?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Named Charles Fernyhough.
I'm a writer and developmental psychologist from Durham University.
And we were having this conversation with him about what happens to young kids when they learn words.
Orange juice. Apple. DJ. Thinking.
Like that, you know, like what happens to the way they see the world. And in the middle of the chat, he said something kind of radical, which was that before they have words...
I don't think very young children do think.
Like think, period? Was there a period at the end of that sentence? You don't think that they think, period?
I don't think they think in the way that I want to call thinking, all right? Which is a bit of a cheat, but let me say...
What he meant is that thinking, as he defines it, is basically just words sounding silently in your head. And before you have those words in your head, you can't think. This is a controversial idea, which we debated back and forth. But for the next few minutes, we're not going to debate it. We're going to jump into it.
But before we do that, let's just announce the topic of the entire hour.
Okay, tell them.
The voices in our heads. I don't know if it's plural or singular. Voices in our head. I think my head.
No, heads is heads. Worse. Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to dive into inner voices is the point. The voices that shape who we are.
That help us through tough times.
Maybe even do us harm.
As a starting point, we're going to take very seriously what Charles Fernyhough just suggested, that before kids have language, they just don't think.
Because whether or not you think it's true, if you follow the idea all the way through, as we're about to do, it does lead you to some interesting places. So, first of all, this whole idea, says Charles, goes back to this Russian guy.
Russian psychologist, Vygotsky.
Lev Vygotsky.
Yeah.
And is he a contemporary dude?
No, he died in the 30s. He was active in
Anyhow, he came up with this idea. It's a really interesting notion of how kids learn to think. And it all begins, he said, on the outside.
Think about a small child who's sitting down solving a puzzle.
Marco, does that look like it goes somewhere?
It goes... here.
You're sitting down and you're working together on a puzzle, and all you've got to do is get these shapes into this board in the right kind of order. If you watch any kid in it with their parent anywhere in the world doing this kind of thing, you'll see them thinking together.
No, that doesn't have an edge.
The child, for example, picks up a picture of a boat and says, you know, where am I going to put this boat piece? And then the mum says, well, have a look at the shape.
Stella.
And then the kid looks at the shape and says, oh, it's got that pointy bit there. And the mum says, right, well, can you see anywhere on the board that has a pointy bit?
Right there.
And so on.
According to Vygotsky, this is the beginning of thinking, this kind of dialogue. And at this point,
it's completely external.
It's all happening in that space between the child and her mother.
Try putting that together. We don't know where it goes yet, but if you put it together...
And only over time does it become internalized.
And how that happens, Vygotsky thought, is that as the child gets older, she'll start to take on the dialogue herself. She'll start to talk to herself.
This is the stage we call private speech.
We've all seen kids do this, right? Where they narrate every single thing they're doing. Put the ball in the box. Take the ball out of the box.
Now, what then happens is a few years further down the line...
These kids who are narrating everything they're doing then go to school, and the teachers tell them, shh, don't talk out loud.
So they kind of get the message that they need to start doing this internally.
So they start to whisper to themselves out loud, and then eventually they whisper to themselves silently. Because the words are now in their head. And that
according to Vygotsky's theory, that is thinking.
Only then, he says... is the child having a thought. Now, forgetting the particulars for a second, the main point here is that those thoughts that are humming along silently in your mind, those thoughts began as a duo with your mom. or a trio with your mom and your dad, or a quartet with your mom and your dad and your sister. In other words, those thoughts began as a crowd.
The logic of it is that all our thinking is full of other people's voices.
Now, most of us know that the voices in our head are just us. But what got us interested in this whole Vygotsky thing is that maybe this idea has something to say to people who actually do hear other voices in their head.
Yeah, Molly.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
You too. Thanks for coming up here.
Yeah.
As we were thinking about this, it just so happened that our producer, Pat Walters, had taken a trip to Denver and ended up tracking down this lady.
And I'm Molly Martin, and I am a psychotherapist, and I run the Hearing Voices Network of Denver.
They met up at this hotel. Molly works with people who hear voices in their heads, and she runs a support group for people to share their experiences. The day Pat was there, she introduced him to a fellow named Marcus.
Hi, I'm Marcus Macias. I'm a voice hearer myself. I hear voices. So, you know, I first started hearing them 20 years ago. So I'm 40 now. So it was when I was 20 when I first started hearing them.
When it started for him, he says, the voices would kind of materialize out of background noise, like the hum of a refrigerator or the whir of a fan.
When I first started hearing them, they were kind of guiding a little bit, you know, like guiding voices. Like
he says initially the voices would help him out, like if he was in an argument and about to say something mean. The voices would warn him.
Be careful, watch out. They'd say things like that, you know, kind of like they're helpful. But then there was like other negative ones.
He's had periods in his life, he says, where the voices have even turned demonic.
Things are a lot better now, though. See, I'm learning how to manage them, you know, because I'm taking care of myself, you know, so.
Okay, so why do we bring this up? Well, clearly for a lot of people like Marcus, hearing voices involves some psychiatric issues, which sometimes for people can be serious, really serious. But here's the weird thing. The experience of hearing somebody else's voice in your own head is actually way more common than you would think. Surveys have been done about this, and the number seems to be between 5 and 10% of normal, healthy people have that experience or have had it at one time. Which brings us back to this Vygotsky situation. What might be happening in those cases, at least if you ask Charles, is a kind of misattribution of your own inner voice. Those voices in your head, which are you, get mistaken to be from someone else.
A nice, simple, elegant demonstration of this is that you take some people who are hearing voices, people with, in this case, a diagnosis of schizophrenia, who hear voices, and you sit them down at a microphone with some headphones on, and you show them some words on a screen. Just flash up some words on a screen, and their task is to repeat the words, to read the words out loud.
Now, if you can imagine, these subjects are seeing these words on the screen. They're repeating them into the mic, and they've got headphones on, so they're actually hearing their own voices as they're doing this. Trick is, the researchers have rigged it so that the voice in their headphones, their voice, actually gets lowered just a little bit right before they hear it. What that means is that if I were to say, "Hello, my name is Jad," what I'd hear in my headphones is,
"Hello, my name is Jad."
And as you know, if you lower the pitch of the voice by a few semitones, it becomes much harder to recognize it.
Because when I'm speaking in this lowered voice, you can still kind of recognize it's me, but it's a little bit harder.
Now, what the experimenters found is that most people, most non-voice hearing, quote-unquote healthy people, when they were presented with the sound of their own voice
lowered, like this, and then asked, "Is this you? Is it a stranger? Or are you not sure?" They did make mistakes. Some mistakes.
The voice hearers made considerably more mistakes.
Really?
Yeah.
Not only that, when they heard their voices lowered, they would very, very often say, "That voice is coming from a stranger.
That's not me. That's not myself. That didn't come from me." Now, of course, that is potentially a frightening experience. That's potentially a very distressing experience.
But not always. Because let's just imagine Vygotsky was right, that the internal voice of our thoughts is actually a blend of all of those external voices from our childhood. So in other words, our mom, our dad, our sisters, brothers, whatever, they're all in there in some way. And that can actually be a comfort. Back at that hotel in Denver, Molly Martin had told Pat
about a woman
who had seen her father murdered.
He was shot in front of her. And she was... It was a robbery. And it was, I believe, at a convenience store.
And for years afterwards, she says, this woman would hear her dad's voice.
Every morning, when she would wake up, he would tell her to make her bed. And he would remind her throughout the day to do more positive things. And if she was doing something, for example, if she wanted, she was a drug addict, and if she wanted to use drugs again, her father would say to her things like, you know, don't do it, you know, it's bad for you, you know, more looking after her. I think she might have been 11 when he was killed, but it was a good relationship during that time.
Yeah, and then it just kind of like stuck, like frozen.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
That story is because it's some foreign voice in our heads. That's a little unusual. I mean, most of us are very familiar with an inner thought where it's yourself doing the talking, so you're listening to your own voice.
Right.
Lord knows I have that experience constantly. sometimes the voices are helpful. Sometimes, as we're about to hear, they can be up to some kind of mischief.
Right. That's actually what our next story is all about. And this one goes back to a psychology professor named Claude Steele.
I got a job offer, this is in the 80s, at the University of Michigan, and it was part psychology and part to administer a minority student program there. And in the process, I saw data that surprised me.
What he saw was a troubling trend. Two kids would enter Michigan. One was black, one was white. They'd come in at the exact same levels.
Same skills, same SAT score.
So theoretically, they should do the same when they get to Michigan. But without fail, or almost without fail, after one semester,
the black kid was winding up with lower grades.
How much lower?
Pretty dramatic. At least 2/3 of a letter grades.
Meaning if the white kid got an A, the black kid, who should be getting an A too, is instead getting a B.
That's right.
Or a B plus. That's significant.
That's significant.
And he also, by the way, saw this performance gap between women and men when it came to math. To the same degree?
The same degree. In advanced math courses, it was comparable. I learned this is a national phenomenon. If I was to walk into almost any college class in the United States, I'd have a very high probability of finding exactly that.
What could explain these differences?
There was something there that people didn't understand and that we certainly didn't understand.
So he figured he would start with the woman in math issue. He brought a bunch of women in and a bunch of men. Sophomores.
Brought them into the laboratory one at a time, gave them a half an hour section of the graduate record exam you take if you're a math major. Very, very difficult math.
Mm.
And sure enough, the women who had all the same credentials coming into that situation performed dramatically worse than the men.
Worse as in?
It'd be a couple hundred points on an SAT test.
Big difference.
So this was a big effect.
So Claude Steele thought, all right, step one complete. I've got a lab situation that resembles the real world. Good. Now the next step is to tweak things a little bit, see if I can mess around with it. Now, normally in these situations,
the test giver's got a white lab coat on and he brings in a big stack of cellophane wrapped tests and he puts a clock on the table. It's all, you know, it's like, that's it's going to intimidate almost anybody.
Maybe that's what's happening, he thought. What if I took away the clock, took away the coat, and most importantly, right before the test, I had the test giver, instead of saying the normal, I'm going to give you a test, pre-test thing, maybe instead say something like this.
Look, you may have heard that women don't do as well as men on difficult standardized math tests. You may have heard that, but that is not true for this particular test.
Oh.
This particular test does not show gender differences, never has, never will.
He wondered if maybe saying that simple sentence before giving the test would have an effect.
And sure enough, I wouldn't be here if their performance didn't go up to match that of the equally skilled men.
That performance gap totally vanished.
Gee, look at this thing. So we raced and did it very quickly, the same kind of an experiment with African Americans.
There, the pre-test disclaimer went like this.
This is an instrument that we use to study problem solving, and it is not diagnostic of individuals' intellectual ability.
In other words, this is not a test of your intelligence. I repeat, not an IQ test.
So just do the best you can.
And with that simple disclaimer at the start,
same kind of an effect.
The black students and the white students were now equal.
just recently, Ryan Brown and Eric Day did an even cleverer treatment. There is an IQ test, which is nonverbal.
It's called the Advanced Progressive Matrices.
It has figures.
Very abstract. They got lines crossing.
That you have checker, to match and so on.
Checks.
It's essentially pattern matching.
Diamonds with dots in them.
Totally visual.
Yeah, and so they could represent that test as it is, as an IQ test. It's in fact seen as the gold standard of IQ tests because it's, quote, culture free.
There's no math. There's no reading.
Because it doesn't involve language. Or you could represent the exact same test as a puzzle.
Puzzle.
Meaning you can give an IQ test to a bunch of kids and the blacks will perform worse. But if you give that same test, lose the word test, lose the word IQ, and just call it a puzzle,
the black participants suddenly jump up in their performance.
Basically, we got a reversal.
When you represent it as a puzzle, blacks perform as well as whites.
They did, yeah.
That's all it takes. Just change a few words.
In fact, there's even better research on this by a guy named Jeff Stone at University of Arizona, who's shown this with golfing tasks, where he's had black and white golfers just putt.
With
so this,
putting?
This can even,
we're
yes,
talking about
even
putting?
Think about what it takes to putt effectively. Are you a golfer?
No.
Ryan's not either, so he doesn't know what he's talking
about. That's right,
about.
So I'm going to make this up. You have to concentrate.
What we did was we got a miniature golf situation where each hole changed and people had to work around obstacles.
This is Jeff Stone. He runs the Social Psychology of Sports Lab at the University of Arizona. And here's what he did. He tested his black and white putters in two scenarios. Scenario one, using the word intelligence.
When we told him it was a measure of sports intelligence, black participants did about 4 strokes worse than white participants.
But when he changed it, took out the word intelligence and framed it instead as a test of your natural athletic ability, there, the results totally flipped.
And we had now whites performing significantly worse than blacks by about 4 strokes. If you look at the recent U.S. Open that was played in San Diego, Tiger Woods and Rocco Mediate went 4 days, 18 holes. They went to an 18-hole playoff on Monday.
Yes!
Oh! And we're still tied.
Sudden death we go.
And Tiger finally won it on the first playoff hole.
Tiger Woods wins a third U.S. Open championship.
By 1 stroke. So when you talk about 4 strokes, that's a huge difference.
All right, so here's my question. Stereotypes are powerful. Okay, that makes sense. Now, but in terms of understanding how this works, can you make this tactile for me? Like if the stereotype that's having all these effects is like a thing, like a like a little gremlin that bites, like when in the test-taking process does it actually like do its damage?
That's going to be way open to debate.
What does seem to be clear from the data, according to Eric Day and Ryan Brown and Claude Steele, is that the gremlin only seems to appear when the test is sufficiently hard.
If the test is easy, it's important to point out, these effects don't happen.
It's not that the gremlin is not there.
Well, he walks in with you, but he doesn't speak necessarily until things get challenging.
As soon as the test gets difficult,
that's where the voices kick in.
Which means that for most of the tests, everybody's doing about the same. It's only at problem number 17, the one about cosines and factorials and whatever, where things start to go wrong, and at least that's the theory. At that problem, the black student starts to stiffen up a little bit.
That's right.
And Claude Steele's measured this.
Their blood pressure is elevated. Their short-term memory is impaired.
It's that flicker of frustration through their body that wakes up the gremlin who starts to whisper in their ear.
I don't know if you can do this.
Is what they say about us true?
They don't think you can do it.
All the usual stuff. And even if the student doesn't believe it, which is likely.
See, you don't have to believe it. That's the kind of insidious thing here.
Just the fact that he has now this extra bit of mental chatter.
That little guy whispering.
Well, it's a distraction.
And that makes their performance go down.
Just a little bit.
All of this dialogue is keeping you from being 100% focused on the task at hand, which is solving these problems.
So the real subtle power of a stereotype isn't that it prevents you from doing the thing you want to do. It distracts you for just a beat from doing the thing you want to do, and that may be all the difference.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Nick, and I'm from Minneapolis. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Ready? Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Today on Radiolab,
Inner Voices.
Yes.
That was me on the inside. You were just hovering above. So far, I think we've had the voices we've been listening to have been causing us trouble, mostly. Yeah. So I think maybe let's just shift gears if we can.
Yeah, because now we got a story about a more helpful inner voice. Comes from our producer, Sean Cole.
Hello.
Hey.
So,
start us off.
Story's about Mel Blanc. A man of many. You know who that is?
No, I don't.
You don't know who Mel Blanc is?
Why? Should I know who he is?
No, you do know who he is because of what he did.
What did he do?
He was the voice of...
Hey, what's up, Jack?
Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
Oh.
And...
You're despicable.
Daffy Duck. Porky Pig.
Lucky me.
Yosemite Sam.
So long, rabbit!
Pepe Le Pew.
You smelled me out, you little sandy witch.
Stand still!
Sylvester.
Okay, pretty cat.
Tweety.
I say go away, boy, you bother me.
Foghorn Leghorn.
Give me back my chicken.
Your chicken?
That was all one guy?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Wow.
Whoa!
Okay, so what's the story?
Dude, I'm nowhere near done with this. Woody Woodpecker?
Guess who?
Mel Blanc. Barney Rubble.
Is it safe to come in?
Mel Blanc. Dino the Dinosaur. Mel Blanc. And on the other side of the anachronistic spectrum...
Oh, you guys won't believe this.
He was Mr. Spacely for the Jetson.
Really?
Yes.
Where's that Jetson?
Let's see.
Who put the antifreeze
Speed Buggy?
In my carburetor?
Secret Squirrel?
Right, Chief.
Captain Caveman? And Twiggy from Buck Rogers, if you ever watch that.
Yeah.
What about the bomb?
Holy this guy was like the voice of my childhood.
Voice says.
Well, it sounds like a crowd.
Oh my gosh. My dad got so many requests to do so many voices.
This is Noel Blanc, Mel's son, his only kid, actually.
Kids would come to the door literally every single day, and he'd answer the door and talk to the kids. And then up at Big Bear, where we are now, when the tour boats come just like they do now, we'd get on the megaphone, do the characters, and say hi to all the tourists, you know, 12 times a day.
Holy moly.
That's how many tour boats we have.
Now, and you do voices, too.
That's right, Doc. I do a few of the voices that my daddy does. And did.
He did 1,500 voices.
1,500?
Yeah. I copy a few of them. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of us that do different voices, and we've never been able to really sound like exactly like him.
So it took many of you to be one of him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, my gosh, yes. I do Bugs, Porky, Daffy, Tweety, Sylvester. But there's other people that do it, too. And all of them sound... You know, if he goes,
what's up, Doc?
You know, it can sound real close to him. But then when you start to do sentences, it becomes very difficult for anybody to sound like him because everybody has their own voice print. And Mel had his own voice print.
But this isn't really a story about voices. Or it is, but not in the way that you think. It's really about what it's like to breathe life into a character. And whether that character can breathe life back into you. See, back in 1961...
Dad and I had started...
Mel and Noel went into business together, producing radio commercials.
Funny commercials. Because humorous commercials weren't really being done at that time. Very few. So we decided to start to do that. We sent out all the brochures. And that's the week... The same week... That Mel... Had a head-on collision... At Dead Man's Curve at UCLA.
Where was he headed?
He had just finished a recording session in San Francisco. He had flown to San Francisco early in the morning, came back, ate dinner with my mom.
And then rushed back out to do another recording session.
And a kid in a 98 Oldsmobile, gigantic car, lost control on Dead Man's Curve.
Head-on collision.
My dad was in an Aston Martin, which was an aluminum-bodied English car, and it folded right up. They had to cut him out of there. Luckily, he was only a block from the UCLA hospital.
Is that like the jaws of life cut him out?
Yeah. They gave him 1,000-to-1 chance of survival. And he broke virtually every bone in his body.
Well, I think that was more than a slight exaggeration, but from his point of view, it probably felt just like that.
This is Lewis Conway.
Lewis W. Conway. I do very little these days.
He's a doctor.
Before I retired, I was a neurosurgeon.
And he was on the floor at UCLA Medical Center back then.
I was a resident.
He was like 29 at the time.
I think I was the first one to see Mel Blanc in the emergency room. completely unrecognizable at the time, you know, blood and gore and so forth. So we cleaned him up, and then it became clear that he was going to be a major celebrity in the place, providing I kept him alive.
When you show up at the hospital, what's the first, how are you greeted there?
By a lot of flashing cameras, and that all of a sudden I knew something was really bad. I met my mom, we went inside. There were a lot of people there. The papers, and because they thought he was going to die. In fact, there was an obituary written in the Honolulu Herald that said Bugs Bunny's dead.
That was the headline?
Headline. And
you must have been really freaked out.
Oh, yeah. Totally. So was my mom. We couldn't believe it. And he was ashen gray. He didn't look like he was going to make it at all.
The doctors did manage to get him stabilized, but he was unconscious.
He was in a coma. So we just stayed there, ran home, take a shower, come back.
For one day, and then the next, and then the next.
We were at the hospital for about 2 weeks, and...
trying to talk to him.
Yeah. Can you hear us? It was always, can you hear me? Dad, can you hear me?
I mean, deeply unconscious, not responding.
I call him Dad, Pop, Father, whatever it is. Mel, we try to do anything.
Not opening his eyes.
There was really no response.
And it became possible that he would never respond.
But after about 14 days, a doctor came in. He was a resident.
Dr. Conway.
This is me, the resident.
He was a resident, and he went over to Mel's bed.
And for whatever reason, maybe just to mix things up,
I said to him, without any real reason to suspect he would know what I was saying, I said to him,
Bugs.
Bugs Bunny. How are you doing today?
And I'll be darned if Mel didn't go,
yeah. What's up, Doc?
He responded as Bugs?
Yeah.
Quite clearly.
What?
Then he went, Porky, are you there?
Dad said, I can hear you. I can hear you. I can hear you.
Oh, my
Tweety,
God.
Are you here?
Ooh. Tiny top putty tip.
Foghorn Leghorn?
Pay attention, son. You see that house over there that says D-O-G? That spells chicken.
He said all that?
Yeah.
Bugs, Daffy, Porky, Tweety, Sylvester.
All these characters.
You went through about 6 characters.
Are you standing there watching this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what's going through your mind at the time?
I'm so excited that he's able to, that he came out of the coma. How else are you going to feel when he hasn't done anything for 14 days, really hasn't been conscious, and then all of a sudden, he's conscious doing these characters.
And then, according to Noel, after doing the characters for a few moments, he just came back.
Where am I? What happened?
As Mel.
Oh, okay. You're at UCLA, you were in a traffic accident. Oh, was anybody else hurt? No, the boy had a scratched knee, I see.
So wait just a sec here. When he said, what's up, Doc,
mm-hmm.
Was that Mel Blanc talking, or was that Bugs Bunny inside Mel Blanc?
That's the question, and it's a question that actually came back again 23 years later.
Mr. Mel Blanc, this is your life.
On TV, on this show, This Is Your Life, which you've heard of, and they bring out a celebrity, and then they take the celebrity's family and everybody they work with, and they say, like, hey, remember this and remember that.
Mel's funny voices used to drive our high school principal crazy.
And, you know, it's all very light and airy and fun until...
At 8:29 p.m., January 24th, 1961, it all comes to a crashing halt.
They start talking about the car accident. And they call the doctor out to the stage.
Neurosurgeon Dr. Lewis Conway.
Enter stage right to tell the whole coma story. And the host says, Doc, like, what did you think when this all happened?
I was astonished. Mel was dying. And it seemed as though Bugs Bunny was trying to save his life.
That is the idea that has survived more than any other part of this story. That's the thing that keeps coming back and back, and it's like, wait a second, like what?
What does it mean?
What does it mean? Yeah. And it just presents all of these questions, like, who is Mel really? Who is Bugs Bunny really? Is when you make somebody up, do they compete with you in some way?
And win.
Right, exactly. Is that more deeply in Mel than Mel is?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
I brought Dr. Conway back to that moment.
It seemed as though Bugs Bunny was trying to save his life.
I don't remember saying that, but I may well have.
Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, I don't really know that Bugs Bunny was that skillful, but so I'd basically say not much to it, I don't think.
So I asked Noel.
It's an interesting headline, Bugs Bunny Saves Mel. He didn't save his life, but he certainly got him out of the coma.
Then he told me something that does feed into the idea that these characters had minds of their own.
Well,
he says as a kid, he would watch his dad perform, and every time
he became those characters. I could turn the sound off in a booth where you couldn't hear him, just turn the speakers off and watch him and know exactly what character he was doing, because his whole body would metamorphosize to that character. He looked like Bugs Bunny when he was doing Bugs. He looked just like Yosemite Sam when he was doing Yosemite Sam. He became really small and timid when he was doing Tweety.
So he was sort of like a method actor.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, the way Noel described it, it was like these characters momentarily inhabited him.
So I think they were part of him, basically.
But so what I don't get, though, is why would he respond to "What's up, Bugs?" rather than like "What's up, Mel?" or "What's up, Dad?" or "What's up, honey?" You know what I mean?
That's a difficult question. You know, I wish I could answer it.
Noel didn't really want to go there.
Anyway, what other questions do you have? You were stuck on that one, and I kind of am stuck on it.
And I know that it's not a question anybody can ultimately answer, but I called up this guy.
This is Oren Davinsky at NYU Medical Center.
A neurologist that we sometimes throw questions like this to, and I ran him through the whole scenario. This guy comes into the room and says,
"Hi, Bugs Bunny, how are you doing today?" And he says, "What's up, Doc?"
Interesting.
So he batted around in his head for a while, and then he said, "Well, you know, it might have something to do with cues, like getting the cues mixed up."
What do you mean?
Well, first of all,
being in a coma for a few weeks speaks to a very significant brain injury.
Uh-huh. And what Oren often sees with people who've had brain injuries, like Mel's, is that they lose the ability to read the cues that tell them who they're supposed to be when. Dad at home, boss at the office, Bugs in the studio, whatever.
Here's a man who no longer has his ability to differentiate social cues of right and wrong, of when to be Bugs Bunny and when not to be Bugs Bunny, where he is and where he isn't.
You have to keep in mind that when he was working, this is a guy who was getting cued all the time.
He was doing 18 radio shows a week at one time.
Whoa.
So he'd just be running down the street from ABC to CBS to NBC, and they'd hand him a script, and he'd run on stage and do it.
I'm a private sad sack.
So he had those characters buried in himself that could come out, surface incredibly fast.
On a dime.
Yeah, here's the script, that's the character, boom.
So if he's got all these characters hanging around in his head,
this town ain't big enough for the two of us,
just waiting for the right cue. And in his head, that part of the brain that interprets the cues is all messed up.
Oh, no.
Maybe in a way, when Dr. Conway said,
"Bugs Bunny, how are you doing today?"
Maybe the way Mel heard it was, "Hey, Mel, you're on."
In his mind, I may have been the director at the time, for all I know.
Even the good doctor went along with this one.
It's as though he was given permission to talk now because it was his time to talk, so to speak.
So, on one level, it's obviously crazy to think that Bugs Bunny saved his life because, after all, he was just a cartoon character. But whether or not those characters saved him, I mean, in that moment, they were the most essential part of him, you could say. Because when the rest of Mel was adrift and sort of lost in the ether, Bugs was there. He was ready to go to work. Which makes perfect sense to Oren Davinsky.
I mean, that was a rehearsed thing that he did. Once you practice things long enough, they kind of become automatic in lower portions of the brain. And that's why when the higher brain's injured, sometimes these lower brain functions can come out so beautifully because they have been kind of wired in over time. So the Bugs Bunny voice was perfectly preserved deep inside.
Bugs Bunny is like crystallized and kept over here in a protective jar away from the rattling cage of the brain.
Exactly. He went down into the safe.
So what ended up happening to Mel?
Well, he took a long time to recover.
And was in a body cast for, 7 months.
But he worked the entire time. I mean, he never stopped working.
Right. Let's go, Fred.
They're bringing the equipment to him?
I brought the equipment in, dangled a mic over the bed, and he started to work there.
In fact,
the first 65 Flintstones.
You would never know this. Barney, in real life,
what's on your mind, Barney? I'm kind of busy.
Was flat on his back in a body cast.
Just passing by on my way to see the doctor. The doctor? What's the matter with you, Barney boy?
And then in 1989, for the first time, Noel and Mel both were starring in this commercial for Oldsmobile. So Mel's 81 in the shtick. They did a bunch of these. The shtick was, you know, not your father's Oldsmobile.
We did the commercial. It took us all day to do it. And he had just gotten over the flu, so he wasn't feeling that great. And I says, Dad, why don't you run over to the doctor? So he goes over to the doctor, and I call the doctor. I says, what's the story? He says, well, he's okay. He's fine. I can give him a shot and send him home, but I'd love to clear his lungs out. So why don't we just put him in the hospital overnight, clear his lungs out, and then send him home? So I talked to my dad. I says, you want to do that? He says, well, okay. What the heck? I'll see you in the morning, Pop. Oh, yeah. Got there the next morning about 7:30. I says, how do you feel? He says, my leg hurts. I says, why? The nurses at the hospital forgot to put up the bed rails on the side of the bed. Well, you know how high a hospital bed is. He had fallen out of the bed and broken his femur. Fat emboli got into the brain by that time. And within 48 hours, he was basically almost brain dead. Yeah. During the next couple of days, he'd come in and out of his coma or in and out of his sleep. And I tried to rouse him with the characters like the doctor had 30 years earlier.
You would?
Yeah.
Bugs, are you in there?
Yeah. It was very difficult at that time because he's 30 years older now. He's 81 years old. And it was difficult to revive him after each time that he would fall back to sleep again.
And just before his dad passed away, Noel says that Mel looked at him, and in the voice of
Yosemite Sam,
he said,
Noel, I love you. And that was about it.
Oh, my God.
It was the last character he did. And the last character on film, or recorded character,
which was in that Oldsmobile ad I told you about,
was Porky saying, that's all, folks.
And that's what his tombstone says, too. That's all, folks.
Wow.
Thank you, Sean Cole.
Sean does some good voices himself, you know.
He does, but we won't share them with you. Not in the company of Mr. Mel Blanc.
Very, very big thanks to Noel Blanc, Mel Blanc's son.
And to Dr. Lewis Conway, the doctor.
And to Robert's boyfriend, Oren Davinsky. That's an inside joke.
I do like Oren Davinsky.
Oh, and a huge thanks to Mel Blanc himself, wherever he may be, for all those voices that populated our youth.
That's all, folks.
Radiolab will continue in a moment.
My name is Carl Hancock, and I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
Thank you.
Three, two, one. Hey, I'm Jihad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Today on Radiolab.
Well, we're talking about inner voices.
And for our last story of this hour, I'm going to switch things up a little bit because, well, this is just one of the most amazing things I've ever heard.
Really?
Yeah. Doesn't have to do with voices, really. It's more like music, inner music.
Yeah.
That's Jessica Benko. She's a reporter.
Yep.
And she's the one who initially told me the story.
So a little while ago, I went up to visit this guy.
Hi.
Bob Milne.
Bob, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Excuse my snowy feet here.
And he lives in a tiny town in Michigan with his wife, Linda.
Hi, Linda. It's nice to see you again.
And who is he?
He's an amazing piano player. The Library of Congress actually called him a national treasure.
Really?
He's had this special relationship with music ever since he was a boy.
Did you grow up with any other instruments inside the house other than the piano, or was that what you started out on?
Well, my mother made me take piano lessons, and I hated it. I didn't like the sound of minor keys, and the piano teachers had me playing a recital in which there was a Schubert minor key piece in it. So on the recital, I played it in major. And everyone thought that was a travesty.
These days, though, his main music isn't so much Schubert. It's actually ragtime.
Ragtime is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, the rhythms.
So the thing about ragtime is that oftentimes the player is actually playing two different rhythms at the same time, one with the left hand, one with the right hand.
And then you put the rhythms of three in the right hand.
The thing about Bob is he can do this like times 1,000.
Oh. What does that even mean?
Well, let me back up. I first heard about Bob from a neurologist named Kirsten Betterman.
Kirsten Betterman.
Who's now at Penn State.
Penn State University. First time I heard about Bob Milne was through friends.
Kirsten heard about Bob from a colleague who'd seen him play for an audience.
Well, I might just take a tune like a...
He was actually playing multiple rhythms with his two different hands and switching back and forth between different pieces of music and carrying on a conversation at the same time. You can look up videos of Bob on YouTube, and you can see him performing and throwing out jokes. But at times, you'll see him carry on a full conversation while playing. From the perspective of a neurologist, this is actually really hard. Because the part of your brain that should be engaged in playing a piece of music that complicated should also be engaged in having a conversation.
The talking part and the playing part are the same part?
They're the same part in most of us.
For most people, that sort of thing, playing a complex piece of music and having a conversation would interfere with one another.
Yes, that's what you usually would think. Unless you're highly skilled and you play maybe one piece of music at a time that you've done multiple times, but even then it would be very difficult to this degree.
So Kirsten got in touch with Bob, and she started asking him some questions.
About the way he would perceive music.
And in the course of chatting with him and talking about how he perceives music and all of this, he happened to say to her...
But I could hear an entire symphony in my head, and I didn't think that was too big a deal because I always listened to two of them at once.
He told her...
I only have to focus on the one mentally that I want to hear at a given time, and then that's a piece I play, but I hear them all ongoing.
Did he just say he can hear two?
Two different symphonies.
In his head.
At the same time.
And we thought this was very unusual.
Yeah. But, I mean, are we talking the full symphonies or just the melodies?
Every instrument.
Every instrument.
And he can focus in and...
Turn one of them up, one of them down, and they both run simultaneously.
Huh.
So then she pushed to the envelope and asked me if I can I hear three.
Three pieces of music.
I said, well, I don't know, never tried.
But he was like, yeah, I think I could do three.
When we challenged him a little bit, actually he said, I can do four if you ask me.
What?
But I wouldn't go any further than that.
No, that's total b- just four symphonies at the same time? That's just nothing but noise.
Absolute cacophony.
You know, the four pieces of music that just was, wow, I said, nobody can do this. You know, so I was really critical.
Yeah, because it's not true.
We had to think about how to test this.
Let me tell you about how the experiment worked, and then tell me if you think it's true.
All right.
We came up with the behavioral test. And
so the first thing Kirsten had to do was find a control, someone to compare Bob to.
Right.
So she found a conductor.
Peter Perret, who's the former conductor of the Winston-Salem Symphony.
Who is himself an accomplished musician. Before the test, she sent him and Bob
4 pieces of music. We had Schubert's Symphony. We had Brahms. We had Beethoven.
And finally, one from Mendelssohn. So you have to keep in mind, these 4 symphonies are in different keys and different tempos.
Very different in their themes and the instrumentations. And the challenge for them was to learn these 4 pieces of music.
Completely memorize them.
4 different tunes, and they only gave me a couple of days to listen to them.
And then play them in their mind, and we would then ask them where in a certain piece they would be after an arbitrary time.
I'm not really following. What did they do?
So here's what they did. Mm-hmm. They put these guys in the scanner, and they said to them, I want you to play the music in your mind.
Play the music in your mind.
Close your eyes and imagine the music.
So no music is playing out loud?
No music playing, just inside their head.
And are they imagining it however they want or on the CD?
Exactly what they had heard on the CD.
So same instruments coming in and out?
Yep.
Same tempo?
Yep.
So if it was Vivace on the CD, Vivace in their head?
Exactly.
And why were they doing this again?
Well, they wanted to see if these guys could track via memory these really complicated pieces of music.
I see.
So they put the guys in the scanner, they're laying there. Mm-hmm. And on a screen in front of them, the word start flashes. And at that moment, they start playing the first piece of music back in their head. In the control room, they're tracking the music themselves to follow the timing.
The researchers.
Yeah.
Oh, so while Bob and this dude are imagining it, they're actually keeping track of where the real CD is?
Exactly. They let it go for a while. And at an arbitrary moment, they say, stop. And then they say, sing to me exactly where you are in the music.
Like the note?
The exact phrase. They go back, they compare the timing.
To the CD.
Right. To find out if these guys can really recreate inside their heads exactly what they'd heard.
And?
So our conductor, our control, was able to listen to one piece of music at a time and was really right on target with the right answer and timing within a second.
Wow. So this conductor's imagined symphony was only a second off from the real one?
Yep. Same with Bob. So Bob's within a note or two.
Not bad.
Now, round 2.
The multi-song task, as we called it.
They told them both to start that first piece of music again. And then a little bit later, they said, start the second piece of music. In your head.
Simultaneously.
Yep.
All right, I'm already like, come on. It's crazy. Like, this is, we slipped into fantasy.
Well, and that's what happened for the conductor. He couldn't do it.
He couldn't do 2 simultaneously.
Yeah, of course he couldn't do it. It's impossible.
There was no chance. He said this is an overwhelming, impossible task.
His brain just shut down.
Well, like he died or something?
He stopped even being able to track the first piece of music.
Ah.
He just got confused. Now we go to Bob.
They put me into the MRI and they asked me to start tune 1 in your head. So I did. Then, roughly 10, 15 seconds later, I got a message on the screen that said, continue listening to 1, start 2. And then 15 seconds later, continue listening to tunes 1 and 2, start 3. And then the same thing with tune 4. And stop. And then Kirsten came on a little I could hear her talking to me from somewhere. And she says, Bob,
tell us, where are you?
Where are you in tune one?
Beethoven's symphony. Right now, what do you hear?
So I told her, and I described what the piece was playing at that point. And the same thing with tune two, three, and four. She announced that I was exactly right on to the note in each one of the symphonies.
Jess, you're telling me something that's just
Kristen's
not...
Kristen's a really... You know, she's got a lot of integrity.
Just my common sense right now is yelling like a three-year-old.
It really is mind-boggling to think about. It makes my brain hurt.
But, we proved it. Yeah, you can do it.
When Kristen gave you the different pieces of music to listen to,
uh-huh.
Did any of them clash?
No. No, they don't clash. They're all just playing different pieces. There's nothing chaotic about it.
All right. So assuming this is true, how does he do this? How does he explain to himself how he does this?
So I think there's two things going on here. The first has to do with emotion.
Emotion.
Bob is using different brain areas, I think. In his case, probably more emotional brain center.
Emotion deepens the way that we experience things, makes stronger memories. And Bob has a really strong emotional relationship with music.
Well, don't we all?
Yeah, but it's a little bit beyond the whole minor keys make me feel sad. He has really specific emotions associated with individual keys on the scale.
Huh.
When I hear C major, it's a very bland key. It's like, I don't know how to describe, it's like eating water soup or something like that. But D major, it's a bright key that makes me want to dance even though I can't dance. And every key, every one of the keys of the piano had a different emotional attachment to me.
So for Bob, if just the keys are triggering different emotions,
yeah.
Imagine what it must be like when you get to actual music.
So you think that something about how he experiences the emotions of the music makes it etch more deeply in his brain or something?
Yeah, I think when he's got these four pieces of music going, he's not thinking hard about tracking each one of them. He's already in them. He feels them inside his body, and you can feel more than one feeling at a time.
Huh.
So that's one idea. The second idea has to do actually more with image and space, really. I asked him if he could try playing back two pieces of music right now. And I asked him, when you hear these two symphonies in your head, what are you seeing?
I can picture two symphony orchestras sitting side by side.
He actually sees the literal orchestras in his head?
Yeah, and I see them as silhouettes. There's no conductor in front of either one. There's a brownish hue out in front of them, like it's the floor, but it's more the color of the deep brown of a violin. And in back of them, there's a semicircle that's bluish in color. Then when I listen to them, I'm going to listen to Brahms' Second Symphony over in the left side. And over on the right side, I'll turn on the Emperor Concerto, third movement of Beethoven. So I'm listening to that. Now, these are in two different keys. Emperor's in E-flat, Brahms is in D. So now, if I want to pay particular attention, let's say I want to listen to the Emperor here, I'm going to go into the E major. I just sped it up. See, I can speed the thing up to go to some other part in it. I can jump backwards. Let's see, just a minute. I can hear it in F. I can put it in any key I want to. But I'm going to roar forward in this third movement of the Emperor here. And I'm listening to the E major variation on the piano, which is just like it's just rocking on this beautiful E major chord, pivoting around to the E flat note and going up and down from there on the piano.
Wow. So his crazy talents may have something to do with this movie making thing that he does in his head.
Yeah, but it's not just a movie, it's like a 3D movie. He can use it to find out where a specific instrument is.
How do you mean?
In his mind's eye, he can fly out over these orchestras and actually look down on the individual instrument he wants to see.
And I'm looking down and I see the piano out in front of them.
He can zoom in and see them playing their instrument.
Okay, now I'm up there in the air listening to this thing, and over on my left side I can still hear this Brahms going along. On Brahms I can only see the silhouettes from the front, whereas the Emperor over here I can see full color in every person's face in it, plus hear the lines that they're playing.
And as he's flying out over these orchestras, the instruments actually get louder and softer depending on where he is. Like if he goes behind orchestra number one.
I can hear the bass much, much louder. Well, let's see. Then if I go over to the left side, I'm hearing the violins.
And he says he can float right above the players and actually see what they're doing.
I can see every wrinkle in the pleated shirts of their tuxedos. And I can see the deep brownish-orangish color of the violas. And I can hear the deep sound, beautiful sound of that low viola. And I can hear every little rosin scratch across their bows.
God, listening to music for this guy must be like an acid trip. The way that he's describing it?
I think it is. And when he listens to recorded music, it's so much diminished from what he feels when he's imagining it.
Huh. So he doesn't listen to CDs.
He cannot stand listening to CDs.
That, wow.
Yeah. He's a real example of the extremes of the human mind.
So what does he do with these crazy talents? I mean, is he like a billionaire?
Nope. First of all, ragtime's not exactly the most popular form of music in the United States at this point, but it's what he likes to play. And he plays, 250 shows a year. But a lot of them are at historical societies or churches.
Well, Linda and I, we've got a small motorhome. It's an airport bus, one of those little 15-passenger buses. It's got a hot shower and a bathroom and a bed, of course.
So, he travels around in his little motorhome with his wife when he can and without her when he can't, and sleeps in Walmart parking lots. He's working on an opera, which is mostly done, and he writes it in his head while he's driving, and then he sits down in a McDonald's and writes it out on paper, and, that's pretty much what he does with his life.
Thanks to reporter Jess Benko for that great story, and also to producer Mark Phillips for making it sound so good. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Cheryl calling from San Francisco. Radiolab is supported by MailChimp, celebrating creativity, chaos, and teamwork since 2001. More at MailChimp.com.